have found the Business Broker Growth Show with your host, Jason Cutter. This is the podcast for brokers who are ready to stop hoping for deals and start growing their pipeline. Our goal is to bring you strategies, stories, and insights that will be a catalyst to move you quickly from transactional deal makers to trusted advisors. Time for Business Broker Growth.
On today's episode, I have John Martinka. He is the co-founder of Nokomis Advisory Service, a boutique M&A advisory firm. And I'm excited, John, to have you on the show. There's a lot we're going to talk about. So glad that you're here based on what we've talked about before.
Yeah, glad to be here. Looking forward to it.
So for the audience tuning in, information will be in the show notes. We'll share some links at the end. Here's the things that I love about you is you're known as the escape artist, registered trademark, because of the work you do to help clients escape their current situations, which I think about that and it's a fun way to go. You're an author. You have 5 books published. You've helped a lot of clients. Your most recent book is called Exit with Style, Grace and More Money. And I just love that in the content of your books and what they're focused on. And so as we kick this off, I would love to hear kind of, let's start with how you got into brokerage, how you got into this industry, what kind of led to you becoming the escape artist?
Oh, I got into it through serendipity. I was doing something I liked but didn't love, and I was in a small Rotary Club here in my hometown of Kirkland, Washington, and the guy who was president of the club the year before me, a little bit older, but not as old as many of the other members in this brand new club. And, we hit it off pretty well. And one day he said something along the lines of, I have always thought you'd be good in this business. And one thing led to another. It took a little while to get moving and get going. I mean, you can't just say, hey, I'm done with what I'm doing. Let's do something new. Not when you got 4 kids at home. And that's how I got into it. And I like the variety, not the necessarily, you could say the variety of clients or deals, but the variety of what I do during the day, every day. The phone calls, Zoom meetings, Mark working on marketing, writing, doing a podcast, analyzing a spreadsheet, analyzing information about a business, negotiating. You can do 15, 20 things in one day, all different. And I don't have the attention span of the engineer who can work on the same bridge project every day for years.
Yeah, you're not a pulling the same lever for 30 years, yeah. Monday through Friday kind of a guy. So, and then how long ago was that? And then, because I'm curious about this, what was the timeline between the guy at Rotary saying you would be great at this to you hanging a shingle or doing whatever it was that made it official? What was that gap for you?
That's a good question. I'd have to think back, but I would say probably 4 to 6 months.
Okay, 4 to 6 months.
Doesn't mean there wasn't some education along the way.
Of course.
Make sure it was right.
Yeah.
What we were going to be doing.
What were you doing before then?
I was in a couple, a sales role.
Yeah.
And unless you're a superstar salesperson with a great product or something, you're sort of stuck. I like being on my own. And I've had my daughter working with me now for 7 or so years. And that's been rather fun, entertaining.
So one of the things that struck me when we first spoke was I was talking about business brokers. And then you were very clear, because in your mind, you have different terms and definitions you use, and what you see a business broker as, and then a intermediary. Share with the audience, kind of how you break those apart, what you see the difference, and maybe it's a professional tier on your end.
Well, if we start at the top, we have investment bankers, and most people listening to this are never going to work with the investment bankers at Goldman Sachs on Wall Street or, doing the public company deals and things like that. But then you have your local, regional, even sometimes national investment bankers that are a notch below that. And, they do more than just sell businesses. They will do some debt and restructuring and restructure financing and things like that. I consider where we are and a number of my friends in the industry to be what I call intermediaries. We're not bankers, but then we're not Main Street brokers selling small businesses and tend to be people who understand a little more about businesses and what makes a business what it is, and getting the client ready for sale rather than somebody saying, I want to sell. Okay, let's go to market. And then trying to disguise anything that could have been taken care of in six months or a year. And by the way, there are a lot of good brokers out there, a lot of Main Street brokers who do a really good job, price things fairly. But I think what we try to do is offer a next level up quasi investment banking. Some people call us a broker. Some people call us a banker. I don't change their opinion. That's just what they want to think.
So for you then, the level that you operate at and what you see yourself in your role as the intermediary, and how much of that is, you said it's being involved, helping that business owner in advance. Is it something you're doing for months, maybe years in advance, helping them set it up for the ones who want to listen, I'm assuming?
We can get in there. We don't do consulting. We don't do fractional C-level work. There are people who do that. But I'll give you an example with someone I've worked with before, and we're supposed to start in next month. And he made it clear, I will do what needs to be done. Coach me, hold me accountable, tell me what needs to be done, all of that.
If you're listening to this and thinking, I want this level of authority, I just don't have the time to build it, that's exactly what Business Broker Growth does for you. Most brokers know that they need consistent content, better positioning, and real digital visibility. They just don't have the bandwidth to create it or the systems to keep it going. And that's what we build for you. The content engine, the visibility strategy, and authority signals, everything you need that we've talked about here. So if you want this impact without adding another full-time job to your plate, go to businessbrokergrowth.com to learn more about what it would look like for your business. Now, back to the episode.
What do you think, or in your experience and or your gut over all these years, what's that timeline, let's say, that somebody, a business owner, would want to start that process, but then also get things in order, right? So you said like 6 months, but you know, and again, I know every business is different, but do you see a good range, a good starting point for somebody as far as leeway?
It depends on where they are and what they've done.
Okay.
So the person I just mentioned, we're going to do a 6 month project. It can be renewable. He feels that in his industry, 2 to 3 years from now, is the window when he wants to sell, and he thinks be a very good window in his industry.
Got it.
I've seen other companies where it's just a matter of getting the books fixed up so that they make sense. and others that it takes longer. We have a client. We started working with them, and we put everything on hold and said, you have a major problem. You have one customer, 63%. Oof. And the owner finally listened. And because we had, you know, a buyer had come in through the side door, and the buyer was just scared to death over that one customer. And the owner, husband and wife, they finally got it and said, yeah, we got to reduce that. We got to get things back in order, because that's discounting the value. And we're staying in touch, but we're not doing anything, because the books are in good shape. The employee base is pretty good. It's just they have to diversify that customer base. That's one of the big red flags all buyers look for, is customer concentration.
Yeah, makes sense. And if it's too much, obviously there's nothing you can do. How often do you see, or have you seen, business owners who just, they don't care? They like this guy you're talking about, eventually he got the message. How many don't get the message? How many want to list anyway? How do you handle that? What do you think intermediaries should do? There's a whole bunch in that one question for you.
Here's my analogy that I love to use. Most business owners do not get up one day and say, you know, I think I want to sell my business in the next 1, 2, 3 years. So let's raise the dimmer switch and make it bright and shiny over the whole company. Everything's ready. They wake up and say, I'm done. flip the switch. Let's sell. Yeah. And I just saw one of those. Someone asked me to take a look at a business he was thinking of buying. And I said, well, he said, yep. The broker said they probably need, I told him they need some time to get things in order. And the guy said, no, I want to sell now. Well, it's not making any money. I mean, it's this business doing 5 to 6 million a year in sales. And after a fair market owner salary, it's making maybe 100 grand. It's not ready. No bank's going to finance it for very much at all.
So, and then what do you do in those scenarios if it's the business owner that's approaching on that?
Just well, you lay it out.
To wish them well.
What they have to do in a day is, no, I want to sell it. And I say, look, you want 5 million, but your business isn't going to get 5 million. And here's the three big reasons why.
Yeah.
But so-and-so said I can get 5 or 6 million. Well, they just want to hook you and bring you in. And then they'll, you know, the old thing that, the market will convince them what it's really worth, but I got the list.
Yeah.
And we are straight shooters. We tell them what we think it's going to sell for. And does that mean it always sells for that? No, sometimes it's more. We had a deal earlier this year that we targeted $4.5 million with our client in the purchase, in our representation agreement. And the purchase price was 5, which made him real happy because he agreed 4.5 was a good number.
What do you think are some of the things that separate good brokers from great brokers and intermediaries? It's just, you know, the industry.
Yeah, the term broker, banker, intermediary. Yeah, yeah, we're all doing the same thing at different levels and different sophistications. Yeah. Part of it is being an open book. And you see, you know, I see a lot of Main Street brokers who put out a one-page overview and a adjusted financial statements. Or the worst I ever saw was a guy put out one or two paragraphs and sent last year's QuickBooks statements. And that's not doing your client a good service. Yeah, I don't care if you're selling a business for 2, 4, 6, or 26 million. You know, you should put out a good marketing product. We get told all the time our SIM, you know, confidential information memorandum, is one of, if not the best they've seen. Now, I've written 5 books, so I think the writing comes into play. But we do have it edited. We have a company that does layout design and does wordsmithing. That's at our cost.
So, yeah. So the presentation, but you said open book. So there's some of that, which is the marketing and the presentation of it. But I feel like there's more for that, for you being an open book.
Yeah, I think it's not. When we put together a memorandum, there's 2 sections that you often don't see: company weaknesses and buyer concerns. Weakness could be customer concentration. We got 2 customers at 18% and 20% each. Disclose it. You know, don't hide it, but say, here's why they're at that level and have been for the last 12 years or something like that. Yeah, a buyer concern may be there's not a next level of management ready to step up.
Got it. So really sharing those things that a smart buyer is going to notice and or ask about, but being upfront and mentioning it first.
Yeah.
My experience is the person who mentions it first is probably going to have the power and control. And if you're mentioning it as the seller side, they're going to respect the fact that you're not hiding anything. I mean, if you're willing to share that, there's probably no other mysteries or anything else that they're going to be surprised by, right?
There are no perfect businesses. There are no perfect deals.
Nope.
No perfect people, no perfect houses, you know, nothing like that. You share the works.
Yeah. Yeah. You've got to. And I think that's important. Now, for you, I know that one of the big things, and you've talked about this, we've talked about this, is education, you know, on your side, educating you, educating the seller, right? You were talking about that kind of ways to help them. You know, what is it that you look for in a owner that you're going to want to work with that's selling?
A good, honest person, nice person, you know, good personality.
Yeah.
You know, you tell you one I walked out on. It was a larger deal than we usually do. And I brought in an investment banker friend and we went to meet this guy and he had a manufacturing business and he dealt with a lot of titanium. And he made it, he was boasting, well, I take all the titanium in on the weekend to the scrapyard and sell it personally to, and gets well into six figures a year on titanium scrap.
Okay.
And we walked out of there and said, if he's doing that and all the other things, little things that added up, we don't want to work with him. He's not, you know, he's not being honest. He's going to be dishonest about other things.
Yeah. And where do you see that getting brokers, intermediaries in trouble where they're not selective on who they're working with, or they just need the listing so they don't care, they look past it and they think, okay, it's not going to be an issue?
Well, I think the biggest thing is, you know, that all-encompassing category of ad backs. You know, we wrote off personal travel. We wrote off my spouse's car, even though they don't work in the business. You know, we go out for dinner, we write it off through the company, even though it's just, you know, husband and wife or husband, wife and kid or two. And it just mushrooms. And there's a story in a couple of my books about a lady who, she had a really nice business and she ran absolutely everything personally through the company. Her husband got deathly ill. I mean, he was dying and she wanted to move so he could be near his family. And she said, if I had known, I wouldn't have done this, because the things that a buyer's not going to buy into are where I would have got a multiple of earnings on those. So if you sell your, whether you sell your business for 4, 5, or 6 times earnings, if you wrote off $100,000 of stuff that's not legitimate and a buyer and bank don't buy into it, that's 400,000, 500,000, 600,000. If they buy into half of it, it's 200,000, 250,000, 300,000. It takes a lot of years of that 50 or 100,000 at a income tax bracket, so let's say a third or so,
yeah,
to make up for that multiple, what that multiple gets. And banks, I've seen banks getting pretty tight on ad backs.
Which is interesting if you think about it, because if somebody doesn't have an exit plan or timeline, they're not thinking of the long-term effects of all those deductions and those things that will be treated as an ad back. But if they do, then they know that it's better to not do that, right? Like you said, the third in tax savings versus the multiple that they're going to get, what's the over-under on how many years? Is
many
that
years.
Even that 1 year worth of the tax savings versus what you're going to get, let alone years of it?
Yeah. A buyer told me, it's not one of our deals, but they said they took it to one of the mega banks. And one of the first things the banker said is, we don't consider any ad backs.
Ouch.
No, wow. Other banks will. And there's a lot of lenders. There's 2,000 lenders in this country. And most of them do SBA loans or and conventional. And there are many who will ignore that stuff. But it's, you got to be able to trace it back to what it, where it actually went, not just the fact they deducted it.
Yeah. Where did that money go? And then, is that a valid ad back? So
they've already been paid for it. So,
yeah. So before we get into the next segment, I'm curious, because you've written 5 books, published 5 books. Again, the most recent one, Exit with Style, Grace, and More Money, which I love, focused on the business side, the business owner side, and that's where you're targeted. What's been the biggest value for you from writing and publishing these books? Because I think about all the brokers out there, all the people who could be creating content that don't. Like, where has this been valuable for you?
It just adds a tremendous amount of credibility and respect as an expert. And not just with prospective clients, but with referral sources.
Yeah.
And I've...
Makes sense.
You know, give away a lot of books to put prospective clients and referral sources. And, you know, I just was at an event last night and one of my attorney friends was talking to some others. He says, yeah, I got a, I've got a stack of his books on my desk to give to people.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating. I wrote and published my first book. It came out in late 2020, and it was the same thing. It was, you know, I've given out a lot of copies. I've shared it with a lot of people. It's helped with relationships. It's helped with lots of things. That's why, you know, we work with a lot of brokers and really try to drive them in that direction so that they have something that's, you know, tangible and separates from the other, you know, dozens or hundreds of brokers in their relative area. Especially,
yeah, and it's a lot of good ones, and it's personality. I know who I wouldn't want to do business with in our area. Okay. And I know who, if someone said, "What do you think about this person?" I'd say, "Yeah, I'd give him an AA+ rating."
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just like any industry, real estate, investment, wealth management, accounting. There's the good and there's the bad, and then there's the bad, the good, and the excellent.
Yeah. I love it. I think that's great. Well, and then the key is, like you said, allocating that time and resources to the marketing side is how do you put yourself in the excellence category, especially from a marketing. And then obviously you got to perform. There is a lot of marketing out there for substandard products. So it's kind of got to go hand in hand with being able to actually be the broker that goes with that.
The ultimate goal is to find the right buyer. And the right buyer is not always the one that offers the most money. I've seen a lot of deals where the most money didn't get the deal because the seller would say something like, "That buyer is my buyer." Mm. And the, you know, the goal, when I say the goal is to find the right buyer, the overall goal is for the seller to get paid and the buyer to be very successful. The employees be taken care of, the legacy to build business continue.
I love it. I think that's great, right? And if that's the goal from the broker intermediary's perspective, then it changes kind of the dynamics and the action steps and everything involved. Going back to what you said about, you know, open, honest, nice sellers, business owners that you want to work with, so that you have a product that somebody's going to buy and be happy with what they bought and grow it, right? And turn it into something where, you know, hopefully down the road, they're still very grateful for what they bought. Maybe even seeing you as the broker who made it happen, even though they were on the buyer side, they still see you as a part of that transaction.
That's what you want. I mean, and again, you know, it's like any industry, the 80-20 rule, 80% of people in my industry do a really good job. I had to tell one of our newer guys, we have, my daughter and I work, and we have a couple of newer guys that have joined us. I tell them, you can't fall in love with your client and you can't fall in love with someone on the other side. So we have a deal that's in due diligence. But prior to that, there's a guy had found us. I can't even remember how. And one of our other associates was working with him, and he fell in, you know, quote unquote, fell in love with him. Yeah. And he had a conversation, and the guy sends a list of questions, and it's like this long. And I said, I wouldn't waste my time. This guy's not going to buy the business. And, oh, but you know, let's see. And he did need the experience of going through it. Okay. You learn from your mistakes. Yeah. A guy at a meeting and with the owners, and it went really well. They talked a long time, and he had more questions, and then he finally makes an offer, and it's half of what the business is selling for. He had an accounting background, is among other things, and you know, he put too sharp a pencil to it. But you know, I'm going to also share there's a lot of the internet and social media and everything has created a lot of bad information, and I don't know what you see, but there are all kinds of these websites and programs, and a lot of is buy a business with no cash down. Yeah, and yeah, you know, it's too good to be true. I've got a book on my bookshelf over here from probably the 70s. Someone gave it to me, and I think it's buy a business with no cash, and what I've come to realize, yes, you can do that. You can buy a lousy business with no cash down. But if it's a good business, the seller controls the deal.
Yeah.
If the business is making its 10, 15, 20, whatever percent profit for the industry or above average and has no big warts like customer concentration, supplier dominance, you know, key employee who could walk at any time, or even owner dependencies, not is negligent, that seller controls the deal, not the buyer. And yet these workshops and mastermind groups, we had someone else look at the same business. And I talked to the lady before and I said, well, I think this business is going to sell for X. And she says, well, that's a lot more than 3x earnings. I said, yeah, this is a manufacturing business doing $7-8 million a year in sales. It's not going to sell for 3x earnings.
Well, it's interesting too, because I think of the equivalent in the real estate space, which is all the, you know, buy houses, no money down, get seller financing, get creative financing, things like that. And your point is exactly correct. You can buy a messed up house that needs a lot of work in all kinds of creative ways.
Yep.
If it's a perfect house in the neighborhood that's desirable, then unless that seller has a serious problem that they need cash for right away, you're not getting it for a steal. It's going to take a lot of work to find those deals in general, because there's not going to be public deals.
Yeah. Jason, to digress real quickly on the real estate thing, I had a client, I did 5 projects with him where almost sold the business when he got hacked for ransomware. Why did he get hacked? His managed service provider got hacked, and all that managed service provider's clients' login information was stolen.
Oh, well, my gosh.
The deal fell apart because it cost him $500,000, most of him in fines for having released sensitive information from all kinds of different state governments. So, but in working with him, one of their many services was having a quote unquote lockbox service. So if I sell you a piece of property directly, there's no bank, that the money would come from you to the lockbox and then into my account. And they would do all of the paperwork and everything else. I'm amazed how many of those they had, because you talk about it, unless it's, you know, no need for cash or whatever. There's a lot of properties were sold by seller. I'm sure it got them a higher price and a higher interest rate. And with real estate, it's a lot easier than business, because it's hard to run a piece of real estate into the ground. Yeah, you can spill stuff all over it.
Yeah.
But most people don't do that where they're living, a meth lab or something else.
Yeah.
You got to still screen your buy. But in business, you can destroy that business pretty quickly.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, for sure. It's totally different than a physical asset that, you know, it's hard to mess up. That even if you do mess it up, there's still something left, you know, with some bones and some structure. So let's move into the next segment, which I'm very excited about. This is the broker growth tips. These are your things that you say. I originally, when I had the idea for the show, I wanted to call them hacks. Hacks feel like it's like a short-term thing where you're trying to game the system.
Yeah.
I think it's really about these marketing tips, the things that, you know, where you know over your years experience and also seeing other brokers who have come and maybe gone from the industry, you know, what works to grow a pipeline, to grow referrals, to grow listings. So what do you have on your list? What's the first one on your list? Maybe not number one, but the first one.
We talked about 5 of them?
Yeah. Let's go through all.
First one. Do great work.
Okay.
Do really good work. From your initial presentation to your marketing materials to how you treat buyers and your client and keep things moving, do great work. It applies to any kind of advisory work, legal, accounting, consulting, IT, selling businesses. Do great work. And what happens when you do great work? Well, your referrals go up because people see how you do it. You know, I have a call in 2 days from now when we're recording this with a pretty major local accounting firm, you know, a couple hundred employees, and a major law firm introducing us to a joint client. And I've worked with both of them, most recently on a deal with this particular lawyer, although I worked at the law firm for 20 years. And they see how you do work and they say, we want you to help our clients. So do great work. And I can also tell you, I got a referral for a deal from another intermediary. She was retiring. It was the last thing she had. It had been hurt. Business been hurt by COVID. She wanted to play with her grandkids, and she turned it over to us. And you know, she'll get a referral fee, but she knew the quality of work.
Yeah. And I think what's really important about that, and I know this to be true, is that in this day and age, and it's not even just generational, it's just in this day and age, there's very few people who put in effort, and there's very few that put in great work and make sure they're doing quality. And so it's really not hard to stand out. I mean, it takes some focus and intention. Like you said, you do great work, but you could probably be very successful just based on that one thing. If you just do great work, you're going to stand out above most people in any industry. We're talking about business broker, intermediary, but that holds true for basically anything. You just do a great job, you're going to pass everybody. Yeah. Like you're going to leave them in the dust. So I love that. Number one, do great work.
You know, there's statistics that say anyone in an advisory role should be spending a quarter to a third or even more of their time marketing. And that's why it's tough. You know, you get people who are in billing hourly. Well, I'm marketing. I'm not generating any revenue. Well, if you're charging for your value, you could get it done in 5 hours instead of 15 that you have to bill for. And you'd have more time to do other things, including marketing. And marketing is, you know, it's how do you bring people towards you? Not chasing them. And it's, you've written books. I've written 5 books. It's being on podcasts. It's speaking. It's sending out newsletter, it's writing articles, it's always having stuff on your blog, it's going to networking meetings, one-on-one groups, hosting events, all that, just to make people aware of you, to bring people to you.
I love it. Always be marketing. And it is fascinating if you think of that 25 to 33% to a third of the time marketing.
Yeah.
The challenges that I see is that brokers, especially if they don't have systems in place, they get busy in transactions. Something works, they get a listing or a couple listings, and then everything else goes out the window.
Yeah. Or I've seen it where there's they're part of a company with quite a few people, and the company brings in the business. Mm. And then what happens if you're not with that company? What happens if the owner of that company gets hit by a truck?
Or the owner stops investing in marketing, or the marketing stops working.
Yeah.
Right. Whatever. That avenue or that mode could just no longer be effective. And then what? It used to be always be closing, ABC. In this case here, I think always be marketing. I think most brokers that I engage with, at least the ones I talk to, there's many out there that I don't talk to, but they're good in the room. They're good at the sales. They're good at the transaction. They're good at building trust. It's just the marketing side. It's the other piece that they're struggling with.
Number three is, this is specifically for selling businesses. It could be real estate or other things.
Sure.
Don't put lipstick on the pig.
Okay.
And it means if the owner says, I want X million, and you say it's worth, you know, you think it's worth 2 million X, but look, we can adjust the financials to show that it's really worth X. It's because, and that's when you're adding back everything, including the kitchen sink, and you know, adding back the whole owner's salary, when everyone knows banks and business appraisers will always put in a fair market salary. They were not going to say it's discretionary. It makes the number look bigger. or I saw one from someone the other day. This is a business doing, what's the one I mentioned before, doing 5 or 6 million a year in sales. And they adjusted the owner's salary to 35 grand.
Wow.
That's under minimum wage where I live. So if you're doing your marketing correctly, you don't have to settle for the best of the worst and put lipstick on it.
Yeah, which then goes back to what we talked about in the first part when we were kind of talking about the industry as a whole, which is there's no perfect business. There's no perfect scenario. There's no perfect anything. And so you just got to call it like it is. Because generally what's going to happen at some point, somebody's going to ask the right question, or they're going to figure it out. Or if they do buy the business without asking the right question, and then they find out later what they ended up buying, they're going to destroy your reputation.
Yeah.
that's not truthful. That's not the full truth. So, right. So number three is don't put lipstick on a pig. All right. What's number four on your list?
It absolutely has to be win-win. You know, this is not politics where you have a winner or loser in every election. This is not a zero-sum game. The economy is not zero-sum, right? The economy can grow for everybody. If I win in the economy, it means others are going to win. In this deal, both sides have to win. You know, the buyer, the seller, the lender, all have to win.
And where do you balance that as a business broker intermediary whose client is the seller? So you have a specific client that you're specifically working for. How do you balance that? Probably going back to the work with open, honest people, don't put lipstick on the pig.
You got to make sure if you're selling a business, you have to make sure your client is willing to sell for what is a fair market price. If they're selling because they have figured out from their financial advisor they need $10 million less taxes and closing costs to retire and live a certain lifestyle, and it's worth $7 million, yeah, you have to make them aware of that, or why work with them? Because it's not going to happen.
What about a fifth one? I feel like we're escalating. They're all adding on. They're all layers on top of each other.
Fifth one has to do with sophistication, and especially if people in this industry want to work with larger deals, more sophisticated buyers. It's understand the balance sheet and working capital. I have accountant friends who will tell me, the profit and loss can easily be manipulated over a certain time period. It's hard to manipulate the balance sheet over, because it's the history of the company for a long time. You know, it tells you, if you without looking at accounts receivable or payables aging, it tells you how much are they carrying in receivables compared to sales. Payables compared to cost of goods sold and whatever else gets paid, over time, not things like payroll or utilities. And then, how much cash are they keeping? And how much equity do they have? Or is the owner bleeding the company? What about capital expenditures? Well, they've had the same, gross $500,000 of tangible furniture, fixtures, equipment, vehicles for the last 5 years. What does that mean? Well, right away, you think they're probably going to have to start spending money on those things, which if you buy it, you're going to be spending money on it. So anticipated capital expenditures, not just depreciation. So if you understand those things, and especially working capital, that working capital is the fuel that drives the business day to day. And it should be included in the price. And working capital not being cash necessarily, but generally receivables and inventory, less payables and accrued liabilities in a simple definition. Of course, if it's manufacturing or construction, you have work in process. But working capital is an asset just like the machines and the inventory is part of it, like the machines and the vehicles and all of that stuff. And more sophisticated buyer you have, the more they're going to insist on working capital.
Taking from that, you're selling a sophisticated business. You need to make sure as the one that's involved with that transaction that you're sophisticated, you understand those things, or you're probably not going to be able to play at that level, play that game.
Or it's going to be very frustrating, especially if someone goes to a client and says, well, you're going to sell your business for $5 million and you're going to keep all the cash and all the receivables. You'll pay off the bills. And then a sophisticated buyer comes in and says, I need working capital.
So out of these five tips, these five things, if you had to pick one, is there any one that you could pick out of these five children as your favorite child?
Do great work. If you're doing great work, it makes the marketing easier. It makes the other ones, you don't have to put the lipstick on the pig because you're getting good referrals, and you're by doing great work, you are putting together win-win deals to consider referring you when you hear someone is for sale, not just your client, but the other side.
Yeah. I love it. Ultimately do great work. All right, let's get into the final segment here. So this is the deal that got away, lessons from the lost deal. You've been doing this for some time. You've seen some deals. You've seen some ones get away from you, probably maybe on the team, maybe other brokers. I know sometimes it's hard to nail down one. I love this segment because there's always lessons to be learned, maybe cautionary tale for other brokers out there. If they want to learn from people's mistakes, usually And then, like you said earlier about new brokers, they got to learn. They got to learn their hard way, falling down themselves, no matter how many times you tell them. What have you got? What is one that jumps out?
Just knowing your buyer. And if you've got to the size where you're getting interest from private equity firms, don't sell to private equity if you don't want to see the business flipped and resold in 5 to 7 years. And we lost a deal because there were three younger family members. Each of the owners had a son, and there was a son-in-law, and there might even been a nephew involved. And one owner especially said, "You're going to sell this thing in 5 years. What are the kids going to do?" They didn't understand that when it's sold the second time, that next level of management is even more important and more desired, but he couldn't get through his head. And he just said, "They're going to sell it in 5 to 7 years. My kid, my nephew, my son-in-law, my partner's kid, et cetera, are all going to be out of jobs." And it collapsed. So if you are worried about it being resold, don't sell to private equity. And now that may cut your options if you're a large enough business.
Because, and what I hear you saying is that with private equity, it's pretty sure that it's going to happen, right? You can plan on that. And if that upsets the current owner, don't do it. Now, doesn't mean any other buyer isn't going to turn around and flip it, but that's an unknown that nobody's really going to know. Yeah. Private equity, you mostly know.
If there's a fund, it's got a life. And if you buy the, if they buy your business 4 years into their 10-year fund, they're going to start selling it 5 years later so they can close the fund out at 10.
Makes sense. And, you know, for owners, some of it's a legacy, some of it's employees, some of the brand they built. No, I think that's interesting. That's an interesting thing that now more than ever, it's becoming more widespread where private equity, especially in some industries where they're just trying to roll up a lot of different businesses all over the country. And so you're going to see that more and more.
And you have different levels of private equity, Jason. You know, the traditional big private equity, not Wall Street private equity, but middle market, lower middle markets. We don't want anything earning less than $5 million a year. And then there's all of a sudden there's ones at $3 million, $2 million. Now you have people saying we're micro PE, might not be a fund, but they've collected some money, their own money, friends and family, et cetera. And there's different levels. But when you get into that level of true private equity where they raised a fund, that's what I was talking about.
Well, it's good to know. It's good for brokers to be aware. They haven't experienced that already. Just obviously be sensitive and understanding. That makes sense. And just be aware and, just face that when it comes. So before we close out, before I get some final advice for you, from you for the audience, for people tuning in, just a reminder what we do here, what we focus on, so that everyone kind of knows the purpose and point of business broker growth. Our goal is to equip brokers with modern marketing systems and do a lot of the things that John was talking about with the content, the authority, the referral partners, and all those strategies helping people get into more rooms. So amazing people like John can do great work once in the room. And I appreciate everything that John has built on his end. And that's really what we strive to do for the right brokers who are looking for those opportunities and really focus on what they do best. So, John, as we close out here, what is the one tip, if you had one piece of advice for winning more listings and referrals, and you can't use anything that you've already said, what would it be?
That's a good question.
I know you want to say do great work, so you can't use that one.
Yeah, I'm not going to say that. I would. So what's the one thing that would help besides
more listings and referrals? Yeah.
Refer to others.
Okay.
Who are good potential referral sources for you.
Okay. What do you mean by that specifically?
Means refer if you meet an attorney and they work in the buy-sell M&A world. And you meet someone who does something else and they say, we need to meet more attorneys, refer them to them, even if it's a referral or it's not just a potential client. You know, we've met a company that does some very advanced tax strategies, much more than what CPAs do. And we've referred them to probably half a dozen people who have been very grateful because they didn't know there were things like this. Well, they're going to think of us in the same way, not just other service providers, but also for clients.
I love it. And I think the big thing I take away from that, which I think is always important, we work with all of our clients this way, and it's also just how I, maybe it's how I was raised, is to give first, right? If you can be a good referral source for people, they're going to appreciate that, because most people just have their hand out and they're trying to take referrals or take business, need it for themselves. If you can be a giver, you set yourself apart, just like your books and just like all that other stuff. So I think that's great. I appreciate you sharing that and you being on the show. For people who want to find out more about what you're doing, maybe check out your books, check out your company, contact you. They can find you on LinkedIn. So, and all of these will be in the show notes for anyone tuning in. But John Martinka on LinkedIn. You can also go to the Nakoma Advisory.com website, or email John at john@johnmartinka.com. Again, John, thanks for being here, sharing all this, and being willing to share what you're doing. And then fundamentally, because you're all about win-win, doing great work. So thank you, John.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
And for everyone tuning in, appreciate you being here, especially in this first season of the podcast, having a lot of fun with conversations like John, sharing as much as we can to elevate just the industry as a whole, moving everybody away, or the people we can anyway, moving away from the used car brokers out there who are just, you know, listing things and doing whatever they want, and going for the intermediaries, the professionals, people like John. So thank you for tuning in. Appreciate you being here. And until next time, stop hoping for deals and start growing your pipeline.
Thanks for tuning in to the Business Broker Growth Show, hosted by Jason Cutter. If today's episode helped you think differently about how to build your pipeline and grow your business, share it with another broker who's ready to make the shift from hoping for listings to engineering them. Join us again for the next episode of the Business Broker Growth Show, where brokers become trusted advisors.